Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40% site-wide. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
All right, talking some NBA playoffs. I think most of you who have been listening know that I am up every night watching all of it. I think it's been great so far. There have been some moments like the Celtics game the other night that aren't necessarily pleasant to watch, but two incredible games again last night. The Pacers have a 2-0 lead over Cleveland after taking the first two games in Cleveland. An incredible comeback last night. And then the Warriors, after losing Steph Curry in the first half, somehow beat the Minnesota Timberwolves in game one on the road, 99-88. There have been 5 second-round games so far, and the road team has won all 5 games. Joining me right now, a longtime NBA reporter, USA Today reporter and writer, Jeff Zilgit. You can follow Jeff on X, on Twitter, at Jeff Zilligitt, Instagram, J Zilgit as well. So I actually want to start with Minnesota Golden State last night. How did Golden State win that game after losing Steph Curry?
A lot of it, Kevin, is defense. When you have Draymond Green, who a finalist for Defensive Player of the Year, you added Jimmy Butler at the trade deadline, and from about that point, I'd say February 8th through the end of the regular season, and let's throw in the 7-game series against Houston, Golden State's had the best defense in the league. They held Houston to under 100 3 times in that series. They held Minnesota to under 90. It's just, you know, Minnesota's offense has struggled a little bit in the playoffs. They scored at least 90 in every 82 regular season game. Now it's twice in the playoffs under 90. And, yes, they missed Steph scoring. And as Jimmy Butler said after the game, it's hard to play without that guy on the court. But they buckle up defensively, Kevin, and that's what they did. And, you know, in today's NBA, there's going to be a lot of talk about the three-point shot, the way Boston missed 45 the other night. Well, when you start off 1-for-20 like Minnesota did on threes, it puts you in a hole that's hard to dig out of. And Golden State might not be the three-point shooting team of the Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, Haliburton days. However, they still had 18 of them last night, shot better than 40% from that distance. And Buddy Hield, you know, he's a great shooter. Kevin, he's not always the most consistent, but when that shot's going down, he's carried them offensively the past two games, and that you know, is how they won that game last night.
Well, and just incredible in Game 7 the other night in Houston with 33, and it was a phenomenal performance. You know, you mentioned defense, and there's no doubt it was hellacious, as it was at times against Houston. They gave up a lot of offensive rebounds against Houston, a lot of second-chance points, not as many last night. But my question to you is, because I didn't watch Golden State a lot during the regular season, have watched all of their playoff games, did they play this much zone during the regular season?
No, they didn't, Kevin. Now, Steve Kerr doesn't mind going to it. He's got a great coaching staff. But Jimmy Butler has allowed them to do some things defensively that maybe they weren't able to do prior to that. You know, off the top of my head, Kevin, I think they were right around 500 when that trade went down, 25 yeah. and 25. And Jimmy made a huge difference. All the little things that, you know, you can find these stats on NBA.com as well, but the deflections, the blocks, the steals all went up. The opponent shooting percentage went down. That's what Jimmy Butler does. Now, I know Jimmy doesn't have that championship ring, and so that's missing from his resume. But there's no doubt with the experience he has, taking the Heat to two finals, playing deep into the playoffs with the Chicago Bulls, having some experience with Philadelphia and Minnesota, all that stuff pays off, and Jimmy wants a title. And when you get an engaged Jimmy Butler, as he is right now, you can see what improvements he can make. And you know what, man? Golden State also needed a little bit of a playmaker to help out Steph Curry offensively, and Jimmy can provide that. So he just eases the burden. And look, Draymond probably isn't going to hit four or five threes very often, but he did last night. But those are the kinds of performances you need. And that collective experience, and again, I know it's not the same Golden State team, but Draymond has played in 100 playoff games. Steph Curry, same kind of deal. And I know he's, you know, left the game with the hamstring injury. And Steve Kerr's experience on the sideline, that helped out a team immensely at this stage of the game.
You know what was interesting, Jeff, is that I'm a massive Jimmy Butler fan this time of year. I mean, what he did in 23 in particular when, you know, he had like 50-something against the Bucks. It was like something like 40-something and 50-something in back-to-back games, averaged like close to 39 or whatever. The Game 7 in Boston when they won that game in the Eastern Conference, or the Game 1 in Boston, and Game 7 in Boston. Amazing. But, you know, last night was weird, Jimmy, in that he was incredible as a facilitator, rebounder, but he wasn't as aggressive looking for his shot. There was a game against Denver in the finals a few years ago where he kind of disappeared in taking shots, which was a weird Jimmy Butler game. And I've watched all of them. I love the player. I just love his IQ, the whole thing. But I thought it was interesting last night because when Steph went out, I'm like, Jimmy's going to have to get 35 for them to hang on to the lead that they have right now and for them to win this game. And he didn't. He was not aggressive as a scorer. I found that interesting. What did you think?
So, Kevin, you bring up a couple things, and I'm playing this through, and I wonder if, you know, Jimmy looks at that situation and says, okay, we don't have Steph. It's going to be really difficult for us to win. How much energy am I going to expend on the offensive end? And can we get it done potentially with someone else? You know, they were playing well when Steph left the game.
Yeah, they
and
were.
So I think that maybe afforded Jimmy a little bit of leeway offensively. And then, you know, again, Buddy Hield did not have a great first half. He really picked it up in the second half. And I wonder, you hear players all the time, they read the game, they let the game come to them, that they don't make predetermined decisions on how they're going to play. And I'm wondering if that was just the case last night. But your overall point is correct. There is these weird games where Jimmy doesn't have that same aggressiveness. And I just wonder if last night he was picking his spots and thought, okay, we don't have Steph. If we end up losing, you know, they're going to need me for game two. And then the way the game unfolded, they get the win. They don't know Steph's status until the MRI results come in, and then you may see a more aggressive Jimmy in game two, depending on Steph's availability.
No, that answer makes sense to me, because we've certainly seen him take over offensively when he feels he has to. Just sticking with last night's game, because I found it fascinating from a number of standpoints. Number one, the Butler angle. Number two, what we just we'll get to the Steph injury. But Steve Kerr went to places on his bench last night in a game in which they had a lead. They had a comfortable lead throughout, but I always felt like Minnesota had a run in them that was going to make this game much tighter, and they got it to 9. They got it to 7, I think, at one point. Yeah. He went to Pat Spencer for like double-digit minutes in the game last night. He really, I mean, sometimes the things he does, and they just seem to pay off more often than not. But I thought it was wild the way he went to the deep, you know, throws of his bench last night.
Well, Kevin, you hit on a couple of things, but also I spent a lot of time with Steve this summer, both at the USA Olympic camp in Las Vegas, but then in the Olympics in Paris as well. And I'm just fascinated by a lot of his decision-making, what goes into it. He's very collaborative. He talks to his staff all the time, whether it's the Olympics or Golden State. And so he's making decisions on the fly. I also noticed in Game 7 against Houston, same kind of deal. Jonathan Kuminga had been getting limited minutes and probably a little bit disgruntled about that. But he went to him early just to give his starters some rest because he knows he's playing them 40 minutes a game. You mentioned the Pat Spencer, the Quinton Post. Kevon Looney got some minutes both in Game 7 and in Game 1. And I think he's just trying to find some spots to give guys a little bit of a breather, knowing that Jimmy's going to get 40. He's probably going to have to do that with Draymond. Buddy Hield close to that. And so that's his coaching decision. And Kevin, I'm a big proponent of depth throughout the regular season. You're going to need some guys to help you out on one of those, you know, lonely February nights. But we see the benches shrink in the playoffs, and all these teams I thought who had great benches are now all of a sudden just playing 7-8 guys. And then you see, well, maybe they're not as deep as I thought. And then, you know, Steve's just trying to buy a little bit of time, making wise substitutions, maybe before he knows a TV timeout is coming, right before a free throw, end of quarter situation. And just to give his starters a little bit extra rest so they have something left in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to watch him, too. You know, a lot of casual fans that start to tune in this time of year, you know, they aren't necessarily huge Draymond Green fans because of the antics, because of the emotions that get to him. He's had back-to-back unbelievable games. Game 7 against Houston, Game 1 last night. By the way, knocking down threes. Like, I think he was 4-for-9 last night from behind the arc. Hit a bunch of them early. He was on fire early on. But, you know, from your standpoint, I've been a massive fan of just his overall basketball IQ, and I think he's a borderline Hall of Famer. I don't know what you think, but I want to hear it.
No, he is. And so you mentioned, and Kevin, the IQ. And that collective IQ, when you add in Steph, we'll get to that, but with Jimmy, with Steve Kerr, okay?
Yeah.
And Draymond might be one of the smartest defensive players the game has seen in you know, a couple of decades or, you know, the past 30 seasons. And so that adds a lot to it. You get him out there, and I know I've talked a lot about Jimmy's defense. Draymond anchors it. And the other thing, Kevin, with the two games we just saw, he was also had to control those emotions because he was playing two guys he doesn't like, Dylan Brooks and Rudy Gobert.
Yeah.
Okay? And so they know that they can't afford to have Draymond on the bench with a flagrant foul too or in the locker room getting technicals, all those things. And he came through for them, and that's the Draymond they're going to need, whether Steph's on the court or not. They're not getting to the finals if Draymond's not playing the way he is, especially defensively, and then a little bit of his offense. He's just vital to what they do. It's the reason they felt that they still have a championship window. Steph, obviously, still all NBA caliber. But with Draymond and Steph even getting a little bit older, it's the reason they went out and got Jimmy, because they think with those three, they can still get back to the finals.
It's fun to watch their team, for sure, because I think they're different than a lot of teams. They don't rely on ISO. Five people are involved offensively, usually, on a significant number of possessions. Their defense, both, especially that it looks like a 1-3-1 that they start in, has given, you know, back-to-back teams trouble. They're just super high IQ. But bottom line is, no Steph Curry means I don't think they can beat Minnesota talk about how long you think he's out with this hamstring injury and whether or not you think they can survive without him.
Kevin, I'm with you. It's going to be really tough to survive without him if it's an extended absence. They're going to do everything they can. You heard a little bit of this on the broadcast last night, and it makes some sense. If it's not sidelining him for the rest of the series and they believe he can get him back, it makes sense to sit him out game two. I realize they would love to go back to San Francisco up 2-0, but 1-1, it came here, got what they needed, at least one. That gives him a couple extra days rest if they're able to sit him, get him treatment, get him some rest, and we'll see what happens. You know, I don't know the severity of that hamstring injury just yet. You know, Kevin, most of these NBA arenas do not have an MRI machine. All they're getting is a quick x-ray looking for some structural damage. And the MRI will give you a more clear picture of how severe it is. If it's just a strain, I think they can work that and get him in shape to play some games. And I know Steph will want to be out there. If it's more severe than that, if there's a partial tear, that's when it's going to become a little bit more problematic for him getting back this series. But overall, even if they were to get past Minnesota without Steph, and he couldn't play the following series, that's going to be even more difficult, whether it's Denver or Oklahoma City.
Yeah. All right, let's stay in the West. Jeff Zilgit from USA Today joining us. I mean, the game one the other night, I never thought for a moment that Denver could win that game. It was fluctuating between, you know, 14 and, you know, occasionally 5 or 6 points. And then the Nuggets came down the stretch. I criticized the strategy yesterday of fouling, not necessarily fouling up three, but how quickly they fouled. They fouled in the backcourt on one of those fouls up three, and then ultimately Holmgren missed the two free throws, and Aaron Gordon knocked down the three to pull out a miracle comeback and a win for Denver in game one. I watched the post game, and they didn't seem to think that they had made a mistake in fouling the way they fouled. What did you think?
I thought they did. And I know Mark Daigneault, the coach, he's going to defend it at Oklahoma City. They've played that way before. Oh, but you hit on it, Kevin. They started it too early, and they just left too much time on the clock and didn't make Denver work for their points. Those two fouls that we're talking about that happened, I think, like at 12.9 or 10.7 seconds, yeah, right around that. Those are 4 points for Denver, Kevin, with barely 2 seconds coming off the clock. And the free throw right there with the three-point shot is the most efficient shot that people take when you talk about how many points per possession that gives you. And then it keeps Denver close with it. And then when someone misses the two free throws like that, then all of a sudden, you know, Denver's got time to get off a pretty good look the way that unfolded with Westbrook getting out in open court, finding Gordon on the perimeter. And so I think they were wrong. I know that they've used this strategy and that's their philosophy. But I think you make Denver take a few more seconds off the clock on each possession, and then it makes it a little bit more difficult on that final shot. Maybe they don't even get one off at that point. And so it was just a little too early is the bottom line. And I think it would come to recognize that. In that moment, I understand why the OKC coach is going to defend it. I think when he has a discussion with his front office, the coaching staff, they'll realize that, you know, it was just a little too early to start that game.
All right, Jokic is just, you know, doing Jokic things, 42 and 22 in game one. The guy that I am shocked about his playoff performance so far, because I thought he was done, he was horrific with the Clippers last year. Russell Westbrook he's been resurrected as a shooter in this postseason. Who saw that coming? He's knocking down all of these threes. I mean, there was a pretty good chance the last few years he was going to break backboard glass before he made a shot. What has happened with Westbrook and his shooting in particular here in the postseason?
I can't explain that portion of it. Other than that, I think he has found a nice spot in the rotation, and he's earned or gained the confidence of Nikola Jokic. Yeah. And I think that's helping him out a ton the way he's playing with that kind of confidence. Look, we've seen Russell, and you saw him here for a little bit in D.C., Kevin. He's not always had the greatest shot, but he could make shots. I don't think, you know, like he's sort of like in the 43-ish percent shooter But knocking down those shots and playing with the confidence that he does has been a bit of a surprise. I wasn't sure I liked the signing in the offseason, but I know Denver had to do something because they were losing guys in free agency, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, some of those guys from the championship team from just 2 years ago, including Bruce Brown, no longer there. And so they needed a little bit more, and I talk about that depth. You know, Denver, another team, not really going much deeper than seven guys. But you talk about Draymond, borderline Hall of Fame. Well, Russ is going into the Hall of Fame.
Sure.
Okay? And so you have that on your side. And I just think the confidence of which with Denver plays, when Joker has that belief in you, it just changes his style right now. And again, that was a great play too, Kevin. Instead of going to the rim,
yeah,
finding Aaron Gordon on the wing right there for the game winner. And so it's sort of, as you pointed out, a really enjoyable story if you're a Nuggets fan.
Yeah, but I think you nailed it. That trade doesn't happen unless Jokic is in favor of it. And they've had a very high efficiency number on pick and roll, the two of them together, all season long. So Denver legitimately stole game one, which, you know, that more fits the description of stealing a game one. Who wins this series? I think the Oklahoma City is still, you know, a solid favorite at like minus 300. What do you think happens?
I still like Oklahoma City. The 68 wins, what they're able to do offensively and defensively throughout the series, I think will ultimately get them the victory. I think they're the better team. But again, that championship experience that Denver has, I know I mentioned guys leaving, but Aaron Gordon, we know Joker, Jamal Murray, they were all on that championship
Porter Jr.
team. Chris Porter Jr., and he struggled a little bit. I think he's got a bad shoulder.
He is.
Christian Brown was on that championship team, maybe not as minutes then as he's getting now. David Adelman, I wrote the other night, I think Denver should give him the job. You know, he wins a game seven. He gets them this game one victory. He's got the coaching pedigree with his dad, Rick Adelman, who's in the Hall of Fame. I think going with some of these guys who might not be the biggest name, you know, pays dividends. I mean, who knew Mark Daigneault from Oklahoma City
right.
Before this? I think there's a ton of Ime Udoka, you know, spent a lot of time as an assistant for Popovich, then gets his chance in Boston. That sort of faltered for off-the-court reasons. But what he did with Houston, and I think David Adelman has the coaching chops, and if he also has the respect of Nikola Jokic, that could go a long way in giving him that job. But I thought that Adelman's been fantastic in figuring out how to, you know, you mentioned the word, steal some victories here in these series. And, you know, I think he did in game one. I just think ultimately, I think Shai Gilgeous needs to be a little bit better for Oklahoma City. He was okay. And I don't want this to be an indictment on who people voted for MVP, whoever
right.
wins this series. But I do think Shai needs to play a little bit better for them to win this series as well.
Let me just ask you one other Western Conference question, because
yep.
I'm a massive Kawhi guy, and I was hoping that the Clippers could knock off the Nuggets. But I knew that going into it, James Harden's going to be the problem more than anything else. Have we come to the conclusion, for those that haven't, that you can't win this time of year if James Harden's one of your top two players?
It's a great question, Kevin. I mean, I think he could be maybe a number two in a different situation. I know Kawhi has number one talent, but I'm just trying to figure out a scenario in which I could see James Harden being the number two guy on a team. I just wonder if Kawhi just, because I love his game too, if he's just not as dominant offensively as you need him to be on a regular basis for James to be the number two on that kind of team. Maybe if James is the number two and in Boston, okay. You know, if you switch out Jaylen Brown for James Harden, maybe that's where, he could be the number two guy. But being the number one or number two on a team that gets to the conference finals or beyond is proving very difficult for James Harden. And, I'm with you, Kevin. The way the Clippers played at the end of the regular season, I thought they had a really good shot to, you know, even get to the conference finals. And yet, when you get into these seven-game series and you start to figure out not only a team's weakness but a guy's weakness, take it away, I thought really Denver, excuse me, did a That's fantastic right. job doing that. And James's history there, I think Denver really focused on some of the things that he can't do in the postseason, like take over a game. And they limited what he was able to do, and we see that that's the problem that the Clippers have with James being the either number one or number two.
I think that, you know, and I think the story's been written on him as a postseason player. He's a Hall of Fame regular season player, there's no doubt. But there seems to me, and I think I said this on the show yesterday, there seems to be either the inability to understand that playoff basketball is different and the level. Look, I blame Ty Lue for some of this. The amount of ISO ball with a guy that dribbles the life out of it for 22 of the 24 seconds and then tries to make a play is just not winning basketball this time of year. So it's either he isn't bright enough to figure out that the game changes in the postseason or that he doesn't care. And I settled on the latter. You know, I just don't think he cares.
Yeah, because to the point about being smart, Kevin, you don't play those regular season games and do what he does. He compiles some assists, Kevin. So he obviously sees the game in certain ways, and it might be that it doesn't care or is just too stubborn to look around and say, hey, this style doesn't get the job done at this point of year. But I'm going to keep doing it anyway because that's what I do during the regular season. And that could be the larger issue as well, a combination of stubbornness and I don't care. This is the way I do it. And I don't know who's going to sit him down at this point in his career right. and change his mind. Yeah. You know, it's not like he's a young guy who's figuring it out. And you can go to him like you can, you know, let's just use Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and say, hey, you know, you haven't been to the conference finals. Look around, see what guys are doing. You can get a guy to play differently. That's not happening with James Harden at this point.
All right, you've been generous with your time. Jeff Zilgit from USA Today joining us. I'll just finish up with this. Will Boston take 63s tonight against the Knicks and miss 45?
Kevin, I'm a huge proponent of the three-point shot, philosophically. I understand its importance, and you know, I'm getting ready to write a story, and I'll give a little bit of away of it. You know, I think the three-point revolution has met its enemy, and it's the anti-three-point zealots that are out there. I'm not one of those, and I realize that that's Joe Mazzulla's style. I just thought at the end of that game that Boston settled for way too many of them. I don't mind them shooting. They were almost at 50 a game during the regular season. They're going to shoot them. Well, let's get beyond that. I just thought they were a little bit lazy about it. They still may take 45 of them tonight, Kevin, and I think that will be enough to get the job done. They just need to be smarter about when and where they take them.
Yeah. You know, shooters never think the next one isn't going in, and I think that the fact that they lost a game in overtime missing 45 threes is almost going to embolden them to say, yeah, that's not going to happen again. Thanks, Jeff, for doing this. Really appreciate it. Maybe we can catch up before the finals.
Sounds good, Kevin. Appreciate the conversation.
Jeff Zilgit from USA Today. Been with USA Today for a long time, covering the NBA in recent years. Something Tim Legler said. Wait till you hear this about the way Boston played the other night. We've got that next. Chris Russell will jump on with us at the end of the show to talk Caps and Carolina. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, and the Team980.com.
College football summer is no time to slouch because we are taking you to school on the Cover 3 podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. It's time for our annual summer school series as we take time to break down some of your favorite teams with experts and insiders who know these depth charts from top to bottom. But summer school is just extra credit as we go through positional drafts, player rankings, and more. Follow and listen to the Cover 3 podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
really have been. I mean, we had an incredible weekend with a Game 7 on Saturday night. Wasn't a great Game 7. Then the Warriors going on the road and winning Game 7 in Houston on Sunday night. Monday night, we had the Knicks-Celtics crazy 45 missed threes overtime game. Knicks were down 20 and came back and won that game. The Nuggets stole one from the Thunder at, you know, with 2 seconds to go. Last night, we had the Pacers down 7 in the last 40 seconds, come back on a Halliburton 3 off a missed free throw to beat the Cavs to take a 2-0 lead. And then the Warriors, even after losing Steph Curry to a hamstring injury, beat the T-Wolves 99-88. There has not been a home team to win a game in the first 5 opportunities in this second round. Tim Legler, one of my favorites, and we'll get Tim on the show. He's calling a lot of these games, but texting back and forth with him during some of these games. And yesterday on ESPN, he went off on Boston the other night, having a big lead, settling for threes, and missing the most threes in NBA playoff history, 45 of them. This is what Legler said about it.
Listen, man, what the Boston Celtics did last night was an insult to basketball, in my opinion, man. That's an abomination. An abomination offensively to play the way they played. And look, if people are going to sit there, well, that's how they play all the time, man. Live, shoot, live by the three, die by the three. What are you talking about? Watch the game. I don't care how many they listed. First of all, I know this for a fact because I've dived into this. The way the league or statisticians or people at the game that are doing the stats label contested, uncontested shots, I've got a massive disagreement about. I've already looked at it in Second Spectrum because you pull up information and like you're like, wait a second, that's not an uncontested shot, whatever. So there's a big number of uncontested shots, and that's what the Celtics contingent and people that love the Celtics or that defend the Celtics are going to say today. Well, they're all uncontested threes. My ass. I watched. I wrote them all down. They were not. Here's the thing, too. There's a difference between what you might even think is an uncontested shot and a rushed shot. You can still have an uncontested shot that's rushed.
Love that last point. Legler is the sharpest basketball mind in terms of analysts on TV. He just is. And one of the reasons is he's still coaching. He's still involved in the sport, you know, coaching high-level AAU teams. But anyway, that last point that an uncontested shot statistically, you know, advanced statistic, you know, sort of measuring a shot is uncontested because it's not necessarily guarded, but it's rushed because you do have a closeout coming, or you've got a fear of a closeout coming. That's almost equivalent to a contested shot when you're rushing shots. I talked about this yesterday. I thought it was the dumbest level of basketball in the second half and down the stretch, and almost too arrogant that I've ever witnessed. It's not going to stop. It is the way they play. They're going to shoot 45 to 50 of these things, and they knock down a lot higher percentage than 25%, and they almost won the game missing 45 threes. So that'll embolden them more than anything else. I hate it, though. And I love NBA playoff basketball, but I hate all of the threes. I hate ISO. I hate two-man exclusively. And what the Celtics do on every possession is they seek out the matchup they want, you know, who they want Jason Tatum to go one-on-one with, who they want Jaylen Brown to go one-on-one with, who they want Derek White to go one-on-one with. And you end up with two-man basketball, best case, and usually resulting in a launched three or a play to go by somebody and then kick back out for an open three. I don't love it. It's not my favorite style of basketball, but they won a title playing that way last year. They're also a pretty good defensive team. And they certainly can beat the Knicks playing this way. I mean, they're not going to miss 45 threes, you know, contested or uncontested. But I agree with Tim. I thought it was nauseating to watch. And by the way, the Knicks play a lot of that, too. There's a lot of ISO with Jalen Brunson, but he just knocked down some truly tough contested shots down the stretch. He's a special shot maker. He is. There are a lot of them in the league. Doesn't make watching that style of play attractive. Be interesting to see what happens tonight. Would not be surprised if the Celtics win big tonight. They are a 10.5-point favorite in Game 2. In fact, my recommendation to keep watching NBA playoffs, tonight maybe take a night off because I see the Thunder and the Celtics winning by big margins tonight in Game 2 to even up their series at a game apiece. All right, when we come back, Chris Russell will jump on. Chris is big hockey guy and was watching last night. We'll get his thoughts on what he thought of the Game 1 overtime loss to Carolina at Capital One Arena. We'll do that next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. We're also on the Team 980 YouTube page, streaming the show daily. When you get there, like it and subscribe to it.
All right. The NFC arms race continues to heat up in the NFC Beast. The Steelers are sending George Pickens and a sixth-round pick to the Dallas Cowboys for a 2026 third and a 2027 sixth-round pick. After signing a three-year deal prior to the 2024 season, Gabe Davis has been released by the Jaguars. He had 20 receptions, 239 yards, and two touchdowns in 10 games played in 2024. The Utah Hockey Club has officially decided upon a name following a 13-month process that included 850,000 ballots cast by fans in multiple rounds of voting. They will now be known as the Utah Mammoth. The Nats split their doubleheader yesterday with the Cleveland Guardians. Game 1, they win 10-9. Jorge Lopez credited with the win. Kyle Finnegan gets the save. And in Game 2, they lose 9-1. Brad Lord, 6 innings pitched, 3 hits, 3 earned runs, and 4 strikeouts. The Caps drop one of the Canes in overtime 2-1. Jacob Slavin hits the overtime winner. The Canes just outplayed the Caps, outshot them too, 33-14. Game 2 will be tomorrow at 6:45 on 106.7 The Fan. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
Did they just out-execute you guys tonight as far as breakouts and doing all the little things that go into winning a game?
Vogues, if we sat here and went through the whole game from breakout to getting through the neutral zone to forecheck to wall play, we could... It wasn't good, and that's the bottom line. Our entire game was not good, and we'll, like I said, we'll regroup and we'll get ready for Game 2.
Spencer Carberry last night after the Caps lose Game 1 to Carolina, 2-1 in overtime. Joining us right now, kind to do it before his show at 1 o'clock, where I'm sure he will have a lot of thoughts on last night's game, is Chris Russell. I mean, you know me. I don't know a lot about hockey, but I like it this time of year. And yep. I open the show by saying, you don't really have to know hockey to know a one-sided beatdown and that the score was misleading like last night's game. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely, because Carolina completely dominated, as Spencer Carberry said, and I was at that press conference, and he went for that was one of the few answers that he actually gave with any kind of detail, and the other one, I think, was to mine about the physical component not being there and how badly Carolina out-hit and out-physicaled Washington, but I'm sure we'll touch on that in a sec, but that could have easily been 3-1, 4-1 at the end of regulation, where you don't even need the game-winning goal because it's not going to overtime. And this is with a 1-0 lead on the Protas goal. This is with surviving a very shaky first period and playing better in the second period, but even as that period went on, when I thought they would really feed off of the momentum, they just didn't have it, Kev. I mean, again, they should have lost this game 3-1, 4-1 in regulation. Thompson saved them. And, you know, they ultimately lost it on a not good clear, surprise, shocker, and ultimately a long-distance shot that kind of trickles through. I thought it got deflected live, but I guess it didn't.
It didn't.
You know, and...
was that a bad goal that he let in?
It's not a great goal. I don't know if I want to call it a bad goal, but it's not a great goal by any stretch.
I have a specific question about last night. And Emily Kaplan was on with us earlier in the show. For those of you that missed it, she's really good. You can find it in the first hour of the show on theteam980.com or by downloading the Odyssey app. But, you know, the 94-34 shot attempt disparity, which is, you know, incredible. Now, she said that's always expected. It's the way Carolina plays. You know, they're analytics driven. They're about shot attempts, and they think ultimately that will lead to more goals offensively. My question to you, as somebody who knows hockey, is do you take chances by being that aggressive? Can part of the cap strategy be we're okay with the ice tilted that much because the counterattack, you know, the counterpunch, we're going to end up with what Ryan Leonard ended up with last night. We're going to end up with a couple of two-on-ones and three-on-twos. And the high-quality chances they got weren't, you know, overwhelming. Is it okay for that disparity to continue in hopes of scoring on the counter?
Well, yes and no. And I'll straddle the fence. Because, yes, if you can actually get those opportunities and finish them. No, if you're getting such limited opportunities, limited shots on goal, limited two-on-one, three-on-twos, limited sustained puck possession, time in the offensive zone to cycle through, you know, the forecheck's not working, so on and so forth. Because, like, you're dealing, I guess the best way I put it is you're constantly flirting with danger. I used to talk with Barry Trotz about this. And I disagreed with Barry Trotz about this, I should say. And he was right, I guess, and I was wrong. And that is, like, that capital, the Capitals championship team and the Capitals teams leading up to that would never pepper the goaltender and the offensive zone quite like you see out of a team like Carolina, right? And my argument was, and I think this would be Rod Brindamore's argument, is you take your chances and you get knockdowns, deflections, weird puck bounces, weird caroms, so on. You just never know. And Barry's point was always quality over quantity. And I do get that, but you can't play a game when you're this suspect, in my opinion, on the back end, right? Don't forget, you don't have Martin Ferravari. You have Alex Alexiev, and he was involved in the turnover on the game-tying goal. I'm not saying it was his fault, but he was involved in that. You can't play this much with the tilted ice in the back end and so on and so forth and expect to get away with it, especially when you're not finishing on the other end or you're not getting any sustained counteraction on the other end.
All right, so best of sevens in all sports, it's about, okay, one game's in the books, now it's about adjustments. And Spencer Carberry, from what I know, from what people have told me, is considered to be a high-level kind of X's and O's coach. So what are the adjustments that he has to make?
In my opinion, they have to, because they're not carrying the puck through, or at least last night, because they're not carrying the puck through the neutral zone and setting up shop and setting up camp and getting that good puck cycle and all the hockey terms, I think you're going to have to play more of a dump and chase forecheck, your ass off in the corners, and use that physicality that they absolutely have the edge on, Kev, to their advantage in the corners to dig pucks out.
The edge isn't as large as it was against Montreal in terms of the size and physicality.
That's fair, but people in Carolina, they know that Carolina's in a little bit of trouble if Washington does what they were able to do at times in the regular season matchups, including the last matchup in the second period of that game in mid-April, where Washington dominated, and it started with Ovechkin as a heat-seeking missile. And I thought a couple of times last night, Ovechkin had a couple of hits in one sequence.
Yeah.
Tom Wilson had a couple of hits inside the first three and a half minutes. Kev, Ryan Leonard had a big hit. Pierre-Luc Dubois had a hit, but I never saw it like a sustained rolling like you did against Montreal. And part of that is because Carolina, with the puck, you know, you're chasing them, and they've got speed, and they've got skill, and they've got transition. So they're going to have to find a way to use that physicality to wear them down over the series. So the only way I can think of course, be better when they have the puck. Yes, we all understand that. But the only way I can think of to use your physicality to your advantage, again, especially if you're struggling to get the puck through the neutral zone and to set up shop in the offensive zone, and you're struggling to get sustained shots and chances is by digging by dumping the puck in and having an aggressive forecheck in the corners and behind the net, so that hopefully you get an opportunity to center one for Dylan Strome or Tom Wilson or Alex, obviously, in the office, or just back to the point for Carlson or Jacob Chychrun, right. Who, by the way, I didn't think Jacob Chychrun played a very good game last night. I thought he was really poor late in regulation, early in overtime, and it almost cost them.
So for you know, the wear and tear of a long series to work ultimately in the Caps' favor, you got to get to a long series.
Yeah.
So last night, they were dominated, almost won a game, and it would have been a stealing of a game had they won that game last night, 1-0, or had gotten a fluke bounce on one opportunity in overtime. Are you concerned after watching what we watched last night that this doesn't get to a long series?
Yeah. I mean, how could you not be? Because even though the positive angle is, hey, they played as bad as they can play, and they could have won if it was a doubt. I can't remember.
Leonard had a breakaway.
Well, Leonard had the breakaway with 5.5 minutes left to go. But what wasn't it Dowd in overtime, I think, on the feed? I want to say it was Dowd.
One chance. But yeah. the puck was dominated by
absolutely
Carolina in the OT.
And that's the problem, is when you look at the sustained control and puck possession and domination, and you realize that this was the one kind of bugaboo about the Capitals. Even when things were going well, Spencer Carberry was not happy about their puck control and their puck possession. Never mind the last month of the regular season. And even at times in Montreal, like, people forget, okay, they beat Montreal 4-1. They were awful in the third period until games 4 and 5.
Right.
And a lot of what we saw sustained over three periods in overtime last night was reserved for Montreal in the third period, Kev. But the difference is Carolina's so much better, deeper, faster, tougher, meaner, skilled, all of that stuff. And they roll four lines. Montreal rolled one line. So this is a big-time problem. Yes, I think they'll make some counters. Yes, I think they'll be better tomorrow night. There's no way. I don't think they can be as bad. I know they're not as bad as they showed last night. Do I think they're going to win? Listen, they're going to have to play a lot better. I hope. But if you go down 0-2 to Carolina, even though they made a living of that in the 2018 Cup playoff run, that's a whole different beast down there.
So are you going to open the show with the series is over?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to say I am very concerned about this series, which I was to begin with, but I did pick the Caps in 7. However, I did pick the Carolina Hurricanes to win last night. I did not think it would be that much of a dominant effort, but I did pick Carolina to win last night.
Well, the good news is we don't have to wait a week for the next game like we did at the
that
end of the
true
Montreal series.
That
That's absurd, by the way. That doesn't make any sense to
well,
me.
Well, you know, the NHL is trying to keep everybody in line, and every league does it a little bit differently, the
They're
NBA.
They're spreading it out.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Game 2 tomorrow night. You're up next. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Kev. Appreciate you.
Chris Russell, everybody. Thanks to Chris. Thanks to Emily Kaplan, who joined us earlier in the show. Jeff Zilgit from USA Today to talk some NBA hoops. And Max did a great job today. Back tomorrow, everybody. Chris is next.